You're listening to the Tech Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next half hour or so, we're going to be talking all things tech. I'm not joined by my fellow presenter, Russ Shaw, of Global Tech Advocates today. I'm all on my own. And actually, that's marvellous, because I have someone that I've been wanting to interview for a very, very long time, and I have it all to myself. So welcome to my guest today, Maggie Philbin. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, it's lovely to be here.
Yes, good. Now, I've got loads to talk to you about. But first of all, I think what I wanted to do is, I used to watch on the television when I was a child, and a bit of a hero really, and my favourite on a Saturday morning used to be Swap Shop.
Oh, I know, it was such a gift of a programme, and I do feel so lucky to have been offered that opportunity. A wonderful woman called Rose, who my daughter is named after, took a massive risk because they interviewed me for that job when I was still a student. I was in the middle of my finals. I never thought I'd get it, because I thought they're bound to need someone with shed loads of experience.
It's a great opportunity.
It was absolutely fabulous, and it taught me so much, because it was, the first Saturday morning show. It was live. It was 3 hours. Really mixed materials, all sorts of guests. So you'd be chatting to David Attenborough 1 minute, and then there'd be a band. It might be Madness. And then, it would be Madness. And then it would be an 8-year-old kid with an extraordinary collection of, leaves or something. So it really helped you understand, how to get the best out of different guests.
And I think things were incredibly different then. So there would only be literally 3 television channels. There wasn't, 800 television channels. There was no mobile phones or computers or tablets. And therefore, it was huge, because on a Saturday morning, particularly if it was raining, as a kid, that's what would keep you entertained. That's what was on.
Yeah, there was no choice. Though I say there's no choice, but we had a great rival, which was Tiz Was.
And forgot about that.
Yeah, and right. So the two shows were really good for each other. They were very different in tone, addressed slightly different audiences, perhaps, but a huge amount of love and care went into both of them. And the production teams and the presenters really cared about the shows.
I mean, it did look chaotic. I mean, obviously there's sort of features that were on each week and all that sort of stuff, and a huge succession of children coming in and out trying to swap stuff. How on earth did they manage technically to get all that right? Because it was live.
Well, I think it was two things. It was Rose Gill, who was the editor, was extraordinary and had great vision and understanding of what was going to work, because this was the first time that you were able to pick up the phone and call in live to a television programme. I believe there were huge issues with the Shepherd's Bush telephone exchange the first week. But then, Noel Edmonds was at the top of his game then. And so he was incredible. I learned a huge amount from Noel and the way he managed things. And I think there was a huge amount of trust given to all of the presenters. So people are often surprised when I say that it was a 3-hour show. We would have a meeting on a Friday, which took place at lunchtime. And Rose had a rule that we wouldn't chat about business until after lunch. So then we'd talk for a little bit. And the
Is that because she's trying to build a team of people who, as you say, trust each other? It's almost like a team building thing.
What she wanted you to do was, she very much wanted you to do whatever you were doing your way, because the way I might do something would have been different to the way Keith Chegwin might do it, or the way John Craven might, or Noel might. And so if she been very prescriptive. We had a running order, but it would literally say Maggie chats to David Attenborough and then
10 minutes.
5 minutes. Noel chats to 3 callers. There was no more than that in the script. And then we all had our different ways of doing that. I'd go home and look at it. I might think about, what questions would be good to ask. But the responsibility was given to you. And that was fabulous, because it meant, As Rose said, she said, because she was obviously very aware that I was incredibly nervous about the whole thing. And she said, look, you know, you're going to make loads of mistakes. It doesn't matter. But make your own mistakes. But, don't make someone else's.
But that did give it an energy, I think. You can tell when something's scripted. It doesn't matter how great an actress or actor you are. I do think you can tell when it's been contrived, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very authentic. That, yeah. You know, and we all liked each other. We got on very well. And that was genuine. And I think that comes
shows.
Through on screen,
yeah,
too.
Definitely.
And it was something that afterwards, when I moved on to Tomorrow's World, there were two important lessons I'd learned on Swap Shop. Number one was, if things go wrong, people generally quite like that. So don't... And the thing is to try and be as comfortable as possible with things not working out as you thought they were going to, because that will be the moment that people will really start watching. Because,
and remember. Yeah,
yeah, and yeah. They, exactly. Yeah. So it doesn't matter, but you just have to be prepared for it. So that was one bit of learning. And I think the other bit of learning that I carried forward into Tomorrow's World was that thing about the team. And I think I was massively fortunate to walk into Tomorrow's World at a time when both on and off screen, the people were extraordinarily good. Mm. And we all cared about a common product. We really cared about Tomorrow's World. Mm. And it wasn't a place for, you know, people to, you know, because there were no stars. It was all about, you know, we want to make the show as good as we possibly can.
So I know you had a great interest in science at school, which probably didn't come through on Swap Shop because it wasn't the nature of the programme itself. An opportunity to do Tomorrow's World with someone with your sort of science background, that must have been, well, just a dream job in a way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wouldn't... While I was at school, I really wanted to be a vet, like lots of girls, to, you know, today.
Even still today, yeah.
Yeah, it's still the same thing, because I think sometimes it's really quite hard, if you enjoy science, to think, well, how might I use this? What might a job look like? And so I was good at things like biology and physics and maths, but chemistry was a bit of an issue for me. And I rapidly realised that without chemistry, my dreams of being a vet wouldn't go very far. So I did an about turn when I was 16 and did arts subjects.
But you've got a scientific brain.
I think what I've got, I'm interested in things. Mm. I'm curious, and it's something I often say to young people now, is that curiosity will take you a long way, because curiosity enables you to ask the questions other people won't. And never be afraid. There's no such thing as a silly question. Because if you're thinking, well, I wonder how that works, or why is that, or, well, what would you do with it? Somebody else is thinking that too. And so, yeah, I think I was curious, and I enjoy people. And that also, I think, is quite helpful in science and tech. And
so for Tomorrow's World, it was on for 8 years, and again, an iconic programme, in essence, and definitely lots of inventions and all sorts of scientific advances, which were then sort of talked through and examined and shown on the programme. Quite a groundbreaking programme, actually. I can't recall anything else that was like that before it came along.
No, and what I think is really interesting is it was never planned. I mean, it ran for the best part of 30 years.
Mm.
It was only originally planned for a series of six.
You know, 30 years on, yeah.
And then after six programmes, they thought, actually, maybe we've got something here. Maybe we'll keep going. And so it did. And the great thing about Tomorrow's World, and again, at that particular time, was this was obviously pre-internet. And if you wanted to know what was on the horizon, then that was the go-to.
It was the only
program.
Place, really, unless you read something in a magazine. But it's the only television thing that I can remember. And there was a succession of really interesting things that were on there.
All sorts of things.
So in your 8 years, what was the most bonkers thing that you saw, really?
Oh, well, there were all sorts of, you know, bonkers things. I mean, and it is quite interesting to see that. I mean, I remember on the programme showing, you know, that actually what you were going to be able to do in the future was, rather than like making your own gin and tonic, you'd be able to buy a pre-mixed drink. I remember thinking that.
Who would do that? Who would buy that?
That's really crazy, you know. And then,
lo and behold,
15 years later, you know, they're on the supermarket shelf. So from little things like that, and then
there's lots of gadgets. I seem to
remember. Loads of gadgets, and then key things like. It was a great time to be on Tomorrow's World through the 80s, because it really was, you know, we were moving into showing what the digital era was going to mean. And I remember demonstrating, you know, famously the first digital camera, and you know, things like being able to have civilian use of GPS and the implications that that was going to have. And
it always seemed very pie in the sky, though, when I used to watch at the time. And then now you think GPS, everybody's got it on their phone. It's just completely domesticated, isn't it?
Yeah, and also what was interesting was all of these things were very much at prototype stage. So when we demonstrated mobile phones and...
A brick.
The brick. I did what I believe was the very first mobile phone conference, and I was given a mobile phone I couldn't possibly afford to buy one. They cost $3,000. Yeah. But they gave me one for the duration of the event. I was very excited to have it. But you never imagine, because we always talked on the programme about one day you will have a computer in your pocket. Never thought it could possibly be this mobile phone, which at that time, if you were lucky, you'd get 30 minutes talk time, and you certainly didn't have signal everywhere you went. And obviously all you could do was talk on it. You couldn't send texts or take images or anything like that. It was limited. But I think the glory of Tomorrow's World was the mixture of things that you had. So you did have tech, and you had prototypes, which, as you say, often look like, I'm sure that's never going to happen. I remember all sorts of tracking devices. You know, one day if you've got a whole load of vans out on the road, you'll know exactly where they are. It was quite interesting. And then there would be things like IVF that we talked about, that we did a lot of medical stories. And then I was watching one recently, which was shared by, I don't know whether you ever follow the BBC Archive on Twitter, but they share all sorts of things. And they shared an item I did about the super glue unsticker. And it's worth looking up.
I'm going to have a look at that.
Because, again, it was a live show. I super glued myself to this model of the Venus de Milo. And then did this item explaining why my finger was stuck so firmly and how I'd got this tube of the stuff. So I wasn't going to have to go to A&E. And I was really glued to it. And then I had to put this...
That's a huge amount of faith in the product there.
In the office when they said, right, what we'd like you to do is to superglue yourself to something. And then I just said, you're mad, I'm not going to do that. But yeah, act of faith. And I look at it and it's a great little 3-minute item.
I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, it's definitely worth a look. So you had a breadth of things. So one minute you might be talking about new ways of constructing houses. The next minute it might
be... I remember there's some stuff in space, wasn't there, and all sorts of other things.
Yeah, a lot on space. You know, we did lots of things about, you know, what in the future, what will we be doing about making sure that the whole world is fed. We do sort of take sometimes big issues and then, you know, trivial times seeming little gadgets.
I quite like that mix for me. And I there's so much going on at the moment. And you and I, before we came on air, we're sort of a similar age, I'm afraid to say. I'm just saying, there's so much going on. It's quite hard to keep up. And I do think that there is room for a programme to do exactly what Tomorrow's World was doing then and having it now. Because I do find, particularly in business, there's a lot of people in their 50s and 60s who are running big corporations who actually haven't got a clue what's going on. And they are making tech decisions, and I do feel there's room for a program that will talk about robotics or artificial intelligence and what it means and how we can use it, you know, and blockchain and what it is and cryptocurrencies and, you know, all sorts of things. I mean, don't you think we should have something like that now?
It's something I wish I could be given a tenner for the number of times people
really?
Say, they say exactly that. I think, obviously,
I think, felt you explain, you know, you and your fellow presenters explain things really, you know, an accessible way. And I think that's missing quite a lot at the moment in terms of tech.
It's interesting because I think there are lots of programmes which do show tech, but they go into the, so they deal with the what, you know, here is an amazing, you know, new piece of software or whatever it is. But they don't show the how, that sometimes they don't show the why, and they don't question. So I've reflected on, well, why is this? And I think one of the great advantages we had back in the day was that fact that there were only three or four television channels. So that was the days of curated viewing. And now it's very, very different. So if you've got a program and people think, oh, I'm not sure I'm going to like this, they can immediately access what they think they're going to like. And the strength of Tomorrow's World was that a lot of people accessed it because they were really waiting for Top of the Pops.
You can't say that.
No, it's absolutely true. I've met a lot of people who are now working in tech or they're engineers, and they say that was why they caught it. They caught the programme and they were drawn into it because of that eclectic mix.
Oh, so then they thought, oh, yeah, and then they thought, quite actually, good. Actually, I'll tune in a bit earlier next
week.
Yeah,
this is more interesting than I imagined it was going to be. Whereas now, I think there is a fear on, by the major channels to have a programme which gives that level of detail, because they think, oh, people won't follow it. They won't stay with it.
BBC does have a duty of education, though, don't you think?
Well,
I
think it should happen. Because I think people are really missing out, because there really is a generation, and by a generation, I'm not just talking about young people here, but who have no idea how things work. And that means it's not only that they can't perhaps potentially build and create all sorts of things themselves, but it also means that's why, you know, we're coming into an era where, you know, with all all of the various sort of cyber threats and all the rest of it, that people can be very, very naive. And a lot of the naivety is because they don't completely understand. What they're opening themselves to, not only personally, but in a commercial sense too, if they're running a business, that, you know, and so that, yeah, I mean, I completely agree. It is there is a real need.
If anybody's listening, there, please hurry up and commission a program, BBC. Maggie will be delighted to be the presenter, of course. So you after Tomorrow's World did lots of things on television. Most interesting for me, though, in 2008, you created Teen Tech. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why? Are you passionate about teenagers getting into tech?
Well, I think many reasons, really. I feel I was just so blessed, really, in being given that opportunity to work on Tomorrow's World. It really did feel like coming home for me. And so I've always had a level of awareness of how easy it is to take a completely different road, just because perhaps the right sort of messaging or the right interventions weren't there to help you understand the potential and the opportunities. So I've always been aware of that, because that's what happened to me. You know, oh, I can't be a vet. Right, that's it then. Let me do arts and I'll do something else. And I was brought home. I was kind of like rescued. I didn't fall completely through the net. And that's happening with young people today. And what made me start Teen Tech in 2008 was, at that time I was working on a breakfast radio news programme, and it meant that I was going out and doing outside broadcasts. I went into a lot of schools, and in the downtime, in between the inserts that I was doing into the show, I would just chat to the kids about anything and everything. So I talked to them about, you know, what they were doing in science or design and technology. And I became really aware of how the kids were enthusiastic about technology, but they didn't see that as anything that related to what they were doing at school.
So what you're saying is that they are curious about it, you know, want to play around with it, whatever, but didn't have any view that somehow that would be part of their future career or what they would do as an adult.
Is that what you mean? It's exactly that. And so I was just aware of that, and I did a conference for someone, and they wanted me to talk about why don't we have enough engineers, and I said, would you mind? Can I go and I want to just go and chat and just film some kids. We've got all of these stats, and I'm fed up to the back teeth of coming out with stats, but I think it might be interesting just to hear it from the horse's mouth. And these little films were really powerful because they showed two things. They showed how creative these kids could be if you gave them an opportunity.
No matter what their educational
level. I mean, what?
Or their upbringing or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I went to this school, and this school were brilliant in that they didn't try and prepare the kids. I said, I want the kids to be totally raw. Please trust me, I will not make anyone look ridiculous, but please don't brief them because this is then going to cloud what they do. And we were in this school with two different age groups, and they were each, while we were interviewing all of the kids individually, we asked them to develop their own ideas. So this would have been 2007 that we did this. And they developed their own ideas for the Olympic Games because we just heard that we're going to have the Olympic Games in 2012. What technology could really improve the experience of the Olympic Games? So they went off and they were working on that, and then we pulled them in individually. And when we talked to them about, so just describe what a typical science lesson is like. And it was just very obvious at that time, 2008, you know, they were so limited in the amount of time for practicals. You know, I remember one of them saying,
it was stand up, chalk and talks, as we say. A bit too much of that.
Yeah, and often it would be if there was any kind of practical, the teacher would do it and they would just watch. And as one of the kids sort of said, and they're not really experiments because we always know what's going to happen. So,
is that to do with money? Is that people, you know, schools don't have the money to spend on actual physical things that the children can play with?
I think there was a bit of both. No, I think the teachers want to do this stuff. It's not about poor teachers. It's about resources, yes, but it's also about curriculums, and it's about, at the moment, I feel that so much of what happens formally at school is we do what we can measure. So we can measure this. We can't measure. If kids were working on a project together where there's a lot of evidence to show how much learning happens when they're able to do self-directed projects, but that's hard to measure.
You're making me get really angry now. I can't help myself.
Yeah. So because it's hard to measure, that doesn't get done. And if you are really lucky, and I'm talking about now, not in 2008, but if you're really lucky, then a school might support it through, there might be clubs, there might be a really brave teacher who thinks, actually, we can embed more of this in the curriculum. So that, for me, is what, you know, needs to change.
It makes me so angry. Because as an employer, what I really want at the moment is, I don't care what exams they've got. We don't even ask for qualifications in my business. I'm just not interested. You know, I want people who's got the right behaviour, right attitude, and I want people who can solve problems, who are curious, who want to learn, who want to be a sponge and absorb things. I don't care what exams they've got, and I'm finding more and more employers like myself are the same. They want a person that can solve problems. Now, if you're in a classroom not solving problems, how are they going to learn to do that? How are they going to learn to think for themselves or whatever? Curriculum is just so old fashioned.
Well, it. You know,
in its structure, not in its content, I meant.
It's not only, it's like if the kids were doing something which was a bit irrelevant and they were really enjoying it, that wouldn't be so bad. But what we have so often are students going through a process which isn't always going to be that beneficial, which a really large percentage of them are not enjoying, and they start to see themselves as failures. You know, I mean, it's awful, you know, when all on those days when GCSE and A-level results come out, and that's, you know, that is the measure.
But they're not failures, we're failing them.
Yeah, exactly so, exactly.
And so how can you have a whole tranche of kids coming out of school and they don't like it and they're bored? I just don't see how that works for anybody.
And it's also awful for the teachers,
of course,
as well, you know, because they don't want, you know, they're the experts and they understand what merely makes a difference in terms of a child's learning. And, you know, it's very dispiriting for teachers, I think, to be pushed down that road. So, yeah, so that was the motivation. And
what are you sort of aiming for?
Well, what we did, I was just really fired up by what I'd heard in that school. And I met up with a mate in Carluccio's. And,
good girl.
And I said, you know, it's just crazy because there's so much. And I say at the time, we happened to be in Reading. And I said, you know, look, we're here. We're surrounded by all of these high-tech companies. And there are all of these kids and they have no idea. They go past these, you know, Microsoft or Intel on the... They've got no idea what happens. They've certainly got no idea about what's happening in startups. And really, we've got to find a way of just bringing that community together so that they can showcase what they're doing and also so they can see what I'd seen in that school, that the kids have got that potential. They are creative, bold thinkers. They do have that
potential.
They've
just got to find the bit they're good at.
Yeah, and so Chris went, well, do it then.
Yeah,
all right,
talking about it, do it.
And so we did, you know, what I thought was going to be a one-off event. It went well and after about 18 months, we had interest from regions around the UK.
So Maggie, what were you getting them to do?
Well, it was around helping the companies actually showcase their work in a way that was really engaging and age relevant. So that's what we did at the event. The event was also very focused. So it wasn't around having, because that was the other thing, because I thought carefully about teen tech. And I thought, we've all been to those like massive, you know, events where you walk in and as soon as you step through, you just think, oh my God, I feel completely overwhelmed. And you don't actually see more than three or four things. So I thought, actually, what we can do here is we will curate what we have at the event. We'll make sure that it's all really good. It's all very engaging. We will timetable small groups of students so that when people are coming into an activity, they come for either half an hour or 15 minutes and it's focused and it's not about how many freebies can I grab. It's about, oh, I just, you know, found out about cybersecurity from the Bank of England.
I just had a little play with this or, yeah.
And it's very much the beginning of a journey. And so what we offer are these sort of large-scale regional festivals where we might have 30 to 50 schools, but smaller groups of students from each school. But there's a plan for
very
next. And then the teacher can go back to the school with those students. They can all enter the Teen Tech Award programme. So a whole year group can then do the award programme. We have innovation days that support them through the award programme. And it's really interesting because obviously we're about to celebrate 10 years of Teen Tech.
That's amazing,
from the autumn onwards, a whole year of celebrations. And of course, we now have students who've come through the whole process. And I think the thing that I feel really proud of, and this is a collaborative undertaking, that's the other important thing, because something I'd learned through all of the years of being asked to launch this initiative or that initiative was that people, if you weren't careful, you started off with good intentions, but it very quickly became about keeping your own organisation going.
It's got to be sustainable, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So the way to make that sustainable was keep the core of Teen Tech small, partner to deliver things, have the IP at the core so that you're developing programmes which you can then give to others to deliver.
And you're
really
controlling that quality and...
Absolutely, yeah, and
direction.
It's always a partnership. So it's not like a franchise where we give, say, right, there you go, thank you very much. We partner on all of the activities so that we can see things which we think, actually, do you know what, you can't do it like that. You know, we're on it.
You can't use our name if you're going to do it like that.
No.
And
so now we work face-to-face every year with about 10,000 young people.
Wow.
And then indirectly, through our resources and with teachers taking the learning into schools and running programs with about 75,000.
So that's great reach.
Yeah, so it is decent. And the thing is, it's focused and it's not one-off. It's a series of interventions. And it's also, we choose where we put the live events and festivals. They're deliberately situated in areas of greater social need. So, and we are careful about, if we're doing in-school work, so this year we've worked with, I think it's about 6,000 young people in Oldham and Derby, with interventions, which mean it's the start of a journey for them, which we carry on supporting.
That's really great. I mean, it's really good. You must find that incredibly rewarding.
Oh, it is. It's been by far. I mean, obviously, people know me for Tomorrow's World, but Teen Tech has been...
This is what you're proudest of.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it has a great impact. And you can see that impact too.
Yeah. And it's so satisfying when you see young people who, for whatever reason, might have been very disengaged at school.
Finding a hook.
Absolutely. And understanding their own potential. Because I think that was the thing that upset me most, was kids not understanding their potential and not understanding what it might take for them.
And a lack of self-worth that goes with that. That then carries on to other things, doesn't it, in adult life and all sorts.
One of the schools I was in Derby, I was chatting to a kid over lunch. I eat a lot of school lunches. And this kid, she was in year seven, so the beginning of secondary. And I said to her, if you could choose anything at all that you would do with your life, what would it be? And don't worry about, oh, I could never be good enough, or I don't know anything about it, or, you know, just what would you really, really like to do? And she said, well, I really like baking and I'd quite like to have my own cake shop one day, but I don't suppose I ever will I? And
that breaks my heart.
Oh, well,
that somebody's already decided that they can't.
And also, just, it's a relatively modest ambition. Mm. And she didn't think that was remotely
possible.
Mm. She couldn't, you know. And it's things.
We need to inspire.
I think it's about understanding the things that do inspire and the things that do interest them. We were in a school in London a few weeks ago, and I'd taken someone from government there, actually, because I really thought, you need to understand where these kids are, because some of the language around opportunities is often not quite right. You know, we think, well, why wouldn't you want to be part of this wonderful world of tech? You know, but
because it's scary and I don't understand I don't see how it will make a difference to my life.
Yes, and I don't understand. And I don't, you know, it's like, I don't understand, why would I want it? And it was interesting because my daughter, who works in San Francisco, was over, and in fact, she'd been the one who wanted to go into this particular school. And it was, you know, we let the kids drive the conversation. So they asked the questions. It wasn't run like a normal panel with me asking the panel questions. You know, we let the students do it. And it was interesting because they weren't asking questions about Rose's job. You know, that wasn't of any interest. But they were really interested in, so you work in San Francisco, so how do you get to do that then? You
know, is that because that's a visual thing that they may have seen on television and they've got a little touch point there somehow?
Yeah, it's tangible to them. Yeah. You know, it's tangible. You know, they think, oh, that would be really cool. You know,
it's really attracted to America. I never quite, but I'm sure it's to do with television programs.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not saying possibly that music. We have to use, you know, working in the States as a draw, because all of these, you know, opportunities are right here. But if that is the point which brings that girl into having an interest in tech and understanding that actually this is a passport to some really exciting jobs and, you know, working with some, you know, it really fascinating people. And yes, it could take you all over the world. But then, so, you know, so be it. But that is the, for that kid, that is the starting point. So Rose could have spent forever talking about, well, you know, I work in tech sales and I do this, that, you know, that
would have just turned them off entirely.
Yeah, that wouldn't
have
worked.
We've got to find ways to bridge, haven't we, somebody's interest.
Well, I think
particularly girls, I think, in tech.
Yeah.
We've still got some pretty dreadful figures in terms of getting 17% of girls in tech. We need to do something.
Well, I always think I always talk about diversity rather than gender.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Gender.
Of course.
Yeah. And the reason being, because I think if you come from a certain kind of family, certain kind of background, doesn't matter whether you're a girl or a boy, you're going to be all right. You know, someone will know someone.
Mostly.
Yeah, mostly, you know. And it's a shame because it might mean that you're working in an area which, and you think, oh, it would have been nice to have done that. But I think the social background, ethnicity, abilities, and in terms of, you know, if you
cultural
we work
norms.
With a lot of SEN
cultural
students.
Norms, all sorts of things, isn't there?
Yeah.
Pressures.
Yeah.
And you're right, it's about diversity. It's not just about gender.
Yeah. And if we put the effort into getting that, improving that, then I think a lot of, I'm not saying that problems will melt away, but I'm just saying I think it would be a shame to get companies which were gender balanced but not socially balanced. Would be a pity. Because we would still have the world of tech being sort of imagined, built,
designed
and run by a really narrow sector of society, for a very narrow sector of society. And we all know that's not sustainable. You know, there are all of the signs around the world that this is not sustainable. And we have to have things which are done, which are very much fairer.
Across the board,
yeah.
I would say. moving swiftly on before we both get ourselves into trouble. you've got this amazing thing that you're doing with teenagers. How do companies engage with you and get involved, or schools? Is there somewhere they can go? Is there a website that they can look
at? Yep. Teentech.com.
Nice and easy. Yep. We'll make sure that's on the website.
Yep. So they can. Yeah, they're very welcome to drop me an email. Which is maggie@teentechevent.com, and it's event singular. Do just drop me
and
an email.
And if you're a corporate and you're thinking that you should be engaging in the community and explaining some of the things you're doing,
yep.
But also schools who would like to get on the programme.
We work with a lot, you know, obviously we work with sort of schools, FE colleges, universities, companies, large and small. We find ways that suit the companies, because if you're a small startup, you don't have the resources that a larger company might have, but you might have specific targets that we might be able to help with. And yeah, so we find a good match. It's not a sort of one size fits all opportunity. And
it's a great program. So if anybody's out there, you need to go on that website and try and get involved. We must inspire our young people to get into tech.
They are our future. I want them to look after me in the future.
Me too.
They've got to come up with better ideas than we've got at the moment.
Health tech, particularly as I'm getting older, seems to be striking home. So just finally, just the next few minutes, your thoughts on the future? Are you very optimistic? Let's say you've been running Teen Tech for 10 years now. What about 2028? Can we skip Brexit though?
Yeah, well, parking Brexit. But I'm fundamentally an optimist. I think tech has the potential to make a massive difference to people's lives. It does require people being perhaps a little bit more generous than they are at the moment. I think in the West, we've been very selfish for a very long period of time, and it's simply not sustainable. And I think something that you do very much learn as you get older, which is that it's incredibly satisfying when you do things which are genuinely for the greater good, and they're not about doing things because it looks good, or it's really very satisfying when you do things which you feel are going to make a real difference. And I think there very much are shifts in that direction. I know that in my daughter's generation, so my daughter's 30, they have a slightly different outlook, I think, in terms of what they want out of life and how comfortable they are living a certain kind of life and knowing that other people don't have access to that kind of life.
I know we're generalising, but I have great faith in that generation. People in sort of late 20s, early 30s, really good faith in them, actually, because they're not buying a lot of the stuff that got drummed into us, I think, and they do believe in tech for good, and if they had a choice, they would work for an organisation that had good morals and ethics, I think. I'm hearing that more and more.
Yeah. Well, I know that that's governed my own daughter's choice of where she works. You know, she was headhunted for some amazing opportunities, but she turned them down just because she didn't like the ethics of a particular company.
I'm waiting for that lot to come into power, because I am optimistic about that generation. Yeah. And I am generalising, but I am. Yeah. I think it's a completely different mindset and a much better one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, think about, and I'm probably starting to get very knitted hatty now, but it's like, you know, we have just this tiny amount of time to do things. So let's do the right things. You know, let's do things which are absolutely trivial. You know, life is not about having a new fitted kitchen. It really isn't about stuff like that. It's about much bigger things. And, you know, just looking at making life, things just much more sort of sustainable, you know, on a global sort of platform is really what I think we should all be working towards achieving. And even, for selfish reasons, we should be doing that. Because otherwise, you know, if we don't give, it will be taken.
Well, Maggie Philbin, I know you've been honoured by all sorts of, I mean, you've got so many honours. It's because of your work, and particularly in tech. And maybe a lot of people don't see you, you know, on mainstream television like they used to, but there is no doubt that the work you're doing has a massive impact. And possibly you might say that impact is far greater than when you were, you know, presenting Tomorrow's World and all those sorts of things. So, you know, take some credit for that. And I'm sure, you know, on occasions you might sit down in the evening while you're watching Holby City, which I know is your favourite programme. You might be thinking that actually, you know, you are making an impact, and it is worthwhile.
Well, it is a collaborative effort. It really is a collaborative effort.
Yeah, take some credit now. really impressed by some of the things you're doing. So don't forget to check out Teen Tech. Thank you very, very much, Maggie, for joining me. It's been a real pleasure. You've been listening to the Tech Talk show, syndicated to radio stations across the UK and further afield, as well as being available on Podbean, iTunes and the podcast app on your phone. Thank you to my lovely guest, Maggie Philbin.
It's been lovely.
Thank you. If you want to recommend any future guests, someone doing something groundbreaking in the tech sector, get in touch with us via Twitter on @TechTalkShowUK. And you need to go onto Twitter to watch some of those things that Maggie was talking about. They sound great. If you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, go to techtalkshow.co.uk or via the Tech London Advocates website. Do have a good week.